Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, the Iowa caucuses have long been prized as the ultimate test of retail politics. But the 2020 presidential race, like everything else in politics, is getting very, very nationalized already. And we're going to talk about how that helped launch the campaign of Beto O'Rourke last week and how it's affecting the campaign of Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, who's really trying to run in Iowa, one state south, as the senator from next door. Plus, we are getting a sense of the early White House strategy when it comes to dealing with investigations by the new Democratic House majority. Ignore them. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in this strategy or non-strategy by the White House and how unusual it is and what exactly about all these investigations Democrats have just launched actually scares the Trump White House. As always, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday. Today, that's March 21st, so it's all up to date as of then. No Mueller report yet, no indictments this week, nothing of that nature, at least as of our taping. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We have in the studio, as usual, senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Charlie, good to see you.
Hi, Scott.
And national political reporter Elena Schneider, fresh off the trail in Iowa. Good to see you, Elena.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so our first data point today is $6.1 million. That is the amount of money Beto O'Rourke raised in the first 24 hours of his presidential campaign, which launched a week ago today. And that number is pretty good. In fact, it's the best we've seen from anyone so far, probably ever, actually. I don't know what the 24-hour numbers have been in past campaigns, but we talked last week about how big digital campaigning is now compared to before. So I think it's probably the biggest, certainly online number ever. $6.1 million in 24 hours. And this speaks to the big national following that O'Rourke built as he was running for Senate in 2018. Now, Elena, you wrote a little bit about this in your most recent story from Iowa because you were there covering a different candidate. You were covering Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, and you got a chance to see her and O'Rourke actually cross paths in Iowa. But you also got this look into how different and diametrically opposed their strategies are.
That's right. So I actually want to sort of put you guys in a time machine and take us back to sort of a pre-internet age in which you would see presidential candidates come to Iowa and you'd learn about them on your local newspaper, on the news that you would watch at night, and that's how you like would meet them and get to know them and like showing up at events. That's obviously the way that we've seen presidential campaigns run for decades. And that's something that when you were from a senator next door, I mean, if you were a next door neighbor to Iowa, that actually really helped you. It sort of was an easy line in. People were already familiar with your name. You sort of had a fluency about the issues. And there was just sort of a familiarity that already existed there. Senator Klobuchar would have benefited from that if she was running for president back, say, 20 years ago, but we're not. And instead, so I showed up on Saturday to see her do a canvas launch with the state Senate candidate Eric Griddens, who was the most popular Democrat in Iowa last weekend, had just about every single presidential candidate come and try and help him out on that race. And she launched a canvas launch inside the Blackhawk County Democrat headquarters. Standing room only crowd, but definitely like fit comfortably into this headquarters. And then 2 hours later, Beto O'Rourke shows up. And the crowd was so enormous that they ended up spilling out from the headquarters and had to actually hold it in this massive parking lot, empty parking lot next to the headquarters. And he filled up that block and then it fed into other ones. So that's sort of a perfect encapsulation of sort of what the difference here is. Like when you've got a senator who has spent a ton of time in Iowa, who knows Iowa, her sister lives in Iowa, like just has so many connections to the state and yet cannot seem to attract the same kind of crowd that a political celebrity has done because the familiarity that he's been able to build via Instagram. And I mean, at this point, I've seen like the inside of his mouth. Like we know Beto O'Rourke better than we probably know most politicians. And it sets the stage for a very different way of campaigning and strategy going forward.
Charlie?
I kind of love this time machine idea. I can't help having it rattle through my brain. You know, back in that time, all the Boston sports teams would have sucked, which would have been great. You know, the political class would have been very different. Nobody would have known who Eric Giddens were. You know, there wouldn't have been Twitter. There wouldn't have been this kind of nationalization of politics. I mean, I think that's kind of brilliant to look at it that way. I mean, I think a lot has changed, not just in the mechanics of politics, but also I think in the way that we've become more nationalized in our elections, more polarized. I mean, you know, I guess what it's also known as ideological sorting. There's a number of different names for it, but you're right. I mean, we've also become more homogenized as a people. You know, you don't see the regional distinctions that we used to have, and you certainly don't see it in Iowa, because just to Elena's point, take a look at, you know, who's won in the last, I guess, the more modern era. Let's say the last 20 years. If you go back to 2020, who's won in Iowa? 2004, John Kerry carries Iowa over a Midwesterner. There was a Midwesterner in the field. Now, Obama's kind of, you know, arguable. Does he count as a Midwesterner? Yes, he's from a neighboring state. But to me, he's not like Amy Klobuchar neighbor. He was a national candidate when he ran for president. He never ran as a Midwesterner. He ran as the guy who had the amazing speech in 2004. And that was not like an Illinois-based candidate. That was a national candidate.
But he did have the benefit of getting a whole bunch of volunteers who were able to just drive over the Illinois border into Iowa and help him out. Not saying that I think that you're right in that he was hardly a Midwestern candidate. But, you know, there are little things on the fringes that I'm sure probably helped him.
Right.
I think it's interesting that, you know, especially as we look kind of below the candidates who are polling, you know, above 15-20% or whatever the front runners are at this point, as we think about how the candidates below them might break through, it just seems like what we're talking about here has kind of closed off a path for them in a way. It and now it's opened other ones, obviously, but there's no real way to envision someone like taking off in Iowa and then becoming a bigger thing because of off the strength of that, right? It's if someone starts to break out and take off, they're going to be doing it everywhere at once. It's not going to be because they shook every hand in Iowa the weekend before. It just seems to be kind of the way this like nationalized political campaigning seems to be going.
Right. And that's borne out by the Iowans that I talked to last weekend who said that they can't turn off MSNBC or CNN. That's where people are getting their news. They're not getting their news on local television. They're on Twitter. They're watching these people interact on Instagram and take those live questions. So it is, I think you're absolutely right in that nobody can sort of, it's harder to build a stealth campaign. I don't want to say that it's impossible, but it's harder to build a stealth campaign on the ground in Iowa as opposed to just sort of exploding everywhere. That's not to say, though, that she can't, and I think she acknowledges this. I mean, I was able to sit down with the senator on Sunday, ask her a little bit about how she felt about being an underdog in this race, how her Midwestern times were going to help her sort of break out. And the way that she sort of laughed off the idea, you know, saying like, look, I understand that it's sort of just a joke that I can see Iowa from my porch. That's sort of a good laugh line in the room. But beyond that, that she understands sort of she thinks that the messages that she's saying, the themes that she's talking about are the ones that both are resonant to the people in Iowa, but also are uniquely authentic to her. And to her experience as a senator, talking about rural broadband, talking about the floods that both Minnesota and Iowa are having to deal with, talking about, you know, being the candidate who wanted to be on the Ag Committee. So I think that that's what she's hoping is going to work, that it's not just simply about regionalism or geography or where you're from, but that she's going to be able to connect with them in a way that is sort of uniquely Iowa. And that very much is up in the air as to whether or not that's actually going to be effective.
Well, yeah, that's going to be interesting to watch. I'm curious to see to what extent that catches fire over the next, what, we got 11 months? 11
yeah.
months till Iowa? Okay.
But even Dave Lobsack, who I think was a little shocked to take a question from a political reporter because he's somebody in the congressional halls who only likes to talk to local press. But
He's the Iowa congressman.
Excuse me. Yeah, the Iowa congressman. And so I told him, I was like, look, I'm in Iowa this time, so you've got a time in your backyard. But even he was sort of acknowledging, look, like, yes, it's an advantage to have spent some time here in the state. But at the end of the day, what every single person wants, and this is always borne out in the conversations I have with Democrats, is who's going to beat Donald Trump. And I think that Klobuchar's pitch is that being from the Midwest, winning in states that Donald Trump was able to flip in 2016 is a part of that.
To me,
that's interesting.
The question you asked now is it more important to have a presence or proximity to Iowa, or is it more valuable to have proximity to Iowa Or is it more valuable to have something of a regular gig on MSNBC, meaning you show up doing hits, hit after hit after hit on MSNBC?
Oof.
You don't have to answer.
No, that's a really good point. And then there's like the third lane, the O'Rourke, how O'Rourke got here in the first place. Right.
The Instagram Live lane.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Charlie, you've been kind of in deep watching what O'Rourke's been up to on this first week in the campaign trail with David Siders. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've thought so far?
Well, I mean, I think it was a little rockier behind the scenes than most people knew. But I think he kind of straightened it out. And he, you know, if you focus on the positives of the launch, you get to see what the promise of the O'Rourke campaign is. So we now have a pretty good idea what the downsides are. That, you know, there's some areas where he's not really well versed in the policy arena, and he's not great there. But what we and there is, you know, some seat of the pants flying going on there. But on the other hand, there is an energy there. There's a charisma there. There is an authenticity there. And we've realized from the Trump election in 2016, authenticity is everything in modern politics, or at least this age that we're in now. It is everything. It is what enabled a man like Donald Trump to get elected. Whether you believe he's authentic or not, that he is authentically Donald Trump. This is something that to me, savvy politicians on both sides say they learned from the Donald Trump victory is you have to be authentically yourself, and that is the only thing that breaks through in this modern political culture. To me, O'Rourke is showing that even as people laugh about him getting up on a coffee table counter or whatever he's doing, it is that energy that he's bringing to the playing field that really shows and is resonating with people. As Elena just made the point about where did people go, you know, which event did they go to? They went to the one with Beto O'Rourke in Iowa, you know, not the one with Klobuchar. Not to take anything away from maybe Klobuchar, but it's just that there's some sort of sparkle to O'Rourke at the moment that he, you know, he grew, he generated in Texas, he honed it a little bit, and there is something about the way he campaigns that people really connect to.
Well, and it's something about the way he campaigns that also gets people wanting to be involved. And that $6.1 million number is staggering in that that's the basis of an entire, I mean, you, like, senators spend years trying to build up that kind of a war chest in preparation for this, and he was able to do it in one day. And if you can sustain that kind of small dollar grassroots energy, as we saw in the 2018 House elections, that can take you so, so far. And sort of those stumbles, in the long term, something he's definitely got to sort of shake out and figure out. Those people who have sort of been inspired by him and are watching him, if they keep giving to him, Beto O'Rourke's not going away for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. It's the exact same thing with Bernie Sanders. Yeah. All right. Well, plenty to watch. Elena, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Of course. Glad to be back from Iowa.
Moving on to our next data point. That number is 17. 17 House committees have requested, so far unsuccessfully, documents and witnesses from the Trump White House on a variety of matters. And in many cases, the White House hasn't even acknowledged the requests. Here to talk about it, we have Anita Kumar from our White House team. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. Thank you for coming in. Anita, you've done the reporting on this. House Democrats, newly in power, newly in the majority, very, very excited about digging in on all manner of investigations into things that have gone on at the Trump White House for the past 2 years. But tell us about what's happening with these requests so far and the responses and how unusual this is or not.
Well, it's never unusual for a president not to want to turn over documents and send witnesses. So let's be clear about that. No one's ever excited about that, I don't think. But what's different, we found, is that generally it's like a little bit of a dance. It's a negotiation. You know, the White House might send a letter back saying, thank you so much for asking for these documents. Maybe we can work on, I know, really nice. Maybe we can work on what day we can really get these to you or what documents we can really get to you. So it's the beginning of a negotiation back and forth between Congress and the White House. We're not finding that this time. What we're finding is the deadlines are coming and going, and the White House isn't even sending the customary polite letter back that says, We got your request and we're looking at it. You know, to be clear, sometimes they're picking up the phone and calling someone or sending an email. But in the past few administrations, I've found talking to people that have worked for Clinton, W. Bush, George W. Bush, and Obama, generally it's that there's a negotiation beginning. And so sort of the bottom line is it feels like the president, at least from the White House, not from the agencies, is saying, I don't really want to negotiate. You know, he's starting out already not wanting to negotiate.
So what happens next year? What recourse do House Democrats have?
So House Democrats will go back and forth. They'll send more letters. I think you saw on the one that got a lot of attention about the security clearances. So this is about the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and whether he had a proper security clearance and whether he should have gotten that security clearance. I think the House Oversight Committee has sent three letters already. So what you'll see is the House is sending multiple letters asking for the same thing. Well, you didn't respond to us last time. We're asking again. Eventually, they'll get tired of doing that, and they'll have to make the decision on whether they want to use their power of subpoena. So the House can subpoena. The House Democrats can subpoena. They couldn't do that when they were in the minority. Now they're in the majority. They can. And they will do that. It's just the question of whether they want to do that on all these investigations. There's so many of them. They sort of have to pick and choose. Now, the White House could still ignore the subpoena.
And then it goes to court, right?
Well, then the House has to vote someone in contempt. So remember back when President Obama was president, Eric Holder was famously, you know, held in contempt. They voted him in contempt. And basically all that does is it sends the whole case to court.
Okay.
And then they duke it out. And you know, that court case with Eric Holder is still going on. So
oh my
it
gosh.
Takes forever for them to get resolved. So you can feel the White House saying, you know, people saying, you know, just take us to court and let's figure it out later.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like House Democrats have some recourse. They have levers they can pull. But in terms of actually investigating the things that they want to investigate, there's not much they can do to accelerate that process if the White House isn't interested in cooperating.
Yeah, I think the bottom line here is it's for all those splashy headlines we saw where, you know, they're asking for this, that, and the other, it's going to take forever for them to get that, even into next year or even beyond the election, the next election.
So, Charlie, is this the White House kind of closing its eyes and plugging its ears and pretending that the midterms didn't happen and that there isn't divided government and they don't have to deal with this? Or is this actually, you know, a political strategy heading into 2020?
Oh, I think it's strategic. I don't think it's them pretending it hasn't happened at all. I mean, I think from that evening when they lost and badly, when Republicans lost across the board, it hasn't been it wasn't an exercise in denial. It was a sort of acknowledgement that, okay, you know, it wasn't a great night, but we won some races and we're moving on. It was almost as if it didn't matter.
To fire Jeff Sessions.
Exactly. It was not like 2006, and it was not like 2010 or 2006 when you had a Republican president acknowledge, yeah, we just got our butts kicked and maybe we need to rethink some things. Or 2010 when a Democratic president said, yeah, maybe we just got our butts handed to us.
What was it that Obama said? Shellacking?
Yeah. And then and what was Bush's term?
The thumping.
So either way, both acknowledge, and I mean, that's typically the way things happen, when you get a resounding result like that. But in the Trump administration's case, the response was very unusual in that they didn't care, and they don't. They've never been a majority oriented administration. They didn't win with a majority of the vote. They don't govern with a majority of the vote in mind. And if they win re-election, it will not be with a majority of the vote. So they don't operate like typical administrations. Even administrations like Bill Clinton, for example, in the 1990s, he never won a majority of the vote, but he always governed with a majority in mind. That was his aspiration. I don't believe that's the aspiration in the Trump administration's case. The base is everything, and they think they can win with their base, so they never deviate from strategy. And in this case here, I think it's just the latest example of we're going to do what we want. We don't care. We're not going to acknowledge the results because we don't care. And we're also not going to acknowledge the request from Congress because, again, we don't care. And I think they're not going to respond to subpoenas because, again, we don't care, and we're not intimidated by the consequences at all. And that is the governance style.
I've been talking to some people who are advising the White House, advising President Trump on what to do, and they think this is going to work to their benefit, that he's going to be seen as a fighter. You know, that's why they supporters elected him, and that's what he's been trying to show the last 2 years, is that he's fighting Congress, he's fighting everyone he needs to fight, and they're going to love this. They're going to eat it up, his supporters. This is the way to go.
That's a great point. What does he lose from following this? He does not lose a single one of his voters. Not a single one.
That's a good point. Anita, obviously the main fight here, we're talking about congressional Democrats on one side, the Trump administration on the other, but it occurs to me, I mean, it seems like how different committee chairmen and investigators decide to handle this intransigence and lack of cooperation on a few issues from the, this seems like it has the potential to set off some fighting among House Democrats as well about exactly how to respond and how aggressively to respond to some of this stuff. And that's kind of been an emerging theme of their young majority so far. It's just trying to figure out exactly how to handle this and how quickly they want to push really hard versus letting things run a little bit at first.
Yeah. And, you know, the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, she's got to have a hand in this, but she's kind of letting all the chair men and women do their thing. What hasn't really gotten a lot of attention is nearly every House committee now is investigating the Trump administration for something. And we tend to think it's like tax returns and Vladimir Putin, but there's tons of other stuff. There's a lot of policy. So they're investigating for things that we've heard about, but, you know, maybe aren't thinking about today, like the family separation policy on the border. So all of those committees need to decide, as you said, how they want to do this. Do they send 10 letters before they issue a subpoena? Do they even issue a subpoena? They'll all have to decide. The thing about it is, if you look at all of those investigations, they can't all issue subpoenas. It's just not practical that all those subpoenas will be issues, that everybody's going to be held in contempt. So they have to pick and choose, and that's where the leadership comes in, House leadership.
That's going to be really interesting to watch. Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, it's not just the White House, right? It's hitting every, you know, agency and department, right? They're looking into stuff about the census with the Commerce Department. There's Homeland Security. There's Health and Human Services is also kind of wrapped up in the child separation stuff. It's touching every.
Yeah, it's actually more requests have been sent to federal agencies and departments than the White House. So the White House is, you know, a handful of things that are the big things that we hear about Vladimir Putin, the security clearances, things like that. But most of them are sent to the agencies and the departments. And just to be clear, the agencies and departments are. They're not giving everything, but they are doing these customary letters. Much polite. And there's a reason for that. They rely on Congress for their funding. They rely on Congress for, other practical things that they need. And so you can see cabinet secretaries, you know, writing back these very polite letters. Now, they may not give them what they want, but they are saying, let's negotiate. So it's very telling. There's a very distinct pattern between the White House and the agencies.
All right. Well, we'll keep a close eye on that. Anita, thank you so much for coming in tell us about it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And Charlie, thank you, as always, for chiming in this week.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And as always, a big thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in this week. Our producer is Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.